Hey, Levitt.
Hey, Dubner. How are you?
Good. Nice to see you in New York.
It's great to be in New York.
Rare treat for me.
Yeah, I don't get to New York so much these days.
We're recording on the Upper West Side, which is near where I live and work. But this was a bit of a schlep for you. You were staying in Midtown. How'd you get here this morning?
Took a taxi.
A taxi?
Yeah.
One of those yellow things?
I did. I probably should have done Uber, right?
Why'd you take a taxi?
When I'm in New York, taxis seem easier. Everywhere else in the world, I take Uber, but New York is the one place where I take taxis.
How do you, as an economist, or how do economists generally feel about Uber?
Economists love Uber.
Steve Levitt is my Freakonomics friend and co-author. He's an economist at the University of Chicago. Why do he and his colleagues love Uber?
Uber is, in many ways, the embodiment of what economists would like the economy to look like, because Uber is a market in some sense, that the prices you pay respond to supply and demand. When there are lots of people looking for rides and not enough drivers, they raise the price. And when there are too many drivers and not enough people, they keep the price low. So that is how economists like markets to work.
But that is not the only reason Levitt loves Uber. Economists often work with elegant theories that can be devilishly hard to demonstrate in the messy real world.
Another reason I love Uber is that I have had a burning question about economics that I've wanted to answer for almost 15 years. And by using Uber data, I've finally been able to get to the bottom of it.
Today on Freakonomics Radio, to the bottom of it we go.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio, the show that explores the hidden side of everything. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
Uber, as you likely know, is a phenomenally successful company that lets anyone with a smartphone summon a car and driver that'll take them just about anywhere. It was founded in 2009. It is now used by some 30 million people globally every month. In the U.S., Uber users made some 62 million trips in July alone. The company is worth an estimated 60-some billion dollars, estimated because Uber is still privately owned, with the value accruing to various founders and funders. Is it profitable? More on that later. Is it universally beloved? No, not universally, because it's threatening to destroy the old school taxi cab and private car industries. But the most important thing to know about Uber, for the sake of today's conversation, is this. The details of every ride taken by every passenger, and even the would-be rides that would-be passengers don't take, those details are captured in a massive database, which, to an economist like Steve Levitt, is an extremely appealing notion. He thought this database might allow him to address one of the central mysteries of his professional life.
I've been dreaming of the day I could answer this question, and it probably says a lot about me.
The question had to do with what economists call the demand curve.
The very first class you take when you go and enroll in economics, introductory economics, typically on the very first day they put a demand curve on the board. And like every other economics student, when I showed up my freshman year in school and saw that demand curve, I just accepted it. I said, well, they put it on the board. It must be real. And I never questioned anything about demand curves. I always just thought of demand curves as something that exist, like buildings or trees. The physics, they have sort of a physicality to them. But then when I went to write my own textbook with Austin Goolsbee and Chad Severson, now this is before Freakonomics, so maybe 13, 15 years ago, I actually had to sit down and write about demand curves. And I thought for the first time, well, wait, what really is a demand curve? And I thought, well, to really bring it to life, I think I have to find one. I have to show one to the students. And I looked around and I realized that nobody ever had really actually estimated a demand curve. Obviously, we know what they are. We know how to put them on the board. But I literally could not find a good example where we could put it in a box in our textbook to say, this is what a demand curve really looks like in the real world, because someone went out and found it.
So you're saying that the demand curve as it exists in economics and in economic literature is kind of a fiction or an invention of economists to explain the rest of the transactions around it.
Exactly. It's an artificial construct, which turns out to be incredibly valuable for organizing the world and knowing how to analyze problems. And in that sense, who really needs to see one or to find one?
So what did you do in the case of that textbook?
In the case of that textbook, we left empty the box where you would. There's an empty box that says, to be determined as soon as someone estimates the demand.
Seriously.
We didn't literally do that, but we looked and looked, and in the end, we didn't really have a very good example.
All right. No offense, but to you and your entire fraternity of economists, it does make us wonder how valuable and legitimate any conclusions are about any transactions if we know that you're faking the demand curve.
Yeah, so we aren't faking it. So I think that's the wrong way to think about it. What I'd really say is that we completely and totally understand what a demand curve is, but we've never seen one. I don't know if it's fair to make physics comparisons, but it's you could imagine something like in the old days when the models had figured out something about protons and electrons, but we hadn't actually figured out how to literally see an electron. And we knew it had to be there from the theory, and then it was just a matter of, you know, making the colliders go fast enough or whatever it takes to see an electron, and then it was confirmed that they were there. So in economics, it's even easier because it's not that we have to wonder whether demand curves exist or not, because we know they exist because we define them and they're there. But I wanted to touch one. I wanted to hold a demand curve, and I had never had the chance to do that until I took Uber, and it suddenly occurred to me that here was a chance to hold a demand curve in my own hand.
Talk just for a minute about the inherent potential conflict of when a private firm works with or enlists academic researchers to use their own data to write a study. You can't blame people for maybe being skeptical that the ultimate conclusion will flatter the firm, either because an unflattering conclusion might not be released or because the data the firm gives the researchers will be selectively chosen to ensure a flattering portrait. So talk to us about how kosher this is.
Yeah, so I think in this particular case, it is extremely kosher, although your worries are not misplaced generally. So I actually went to Uber. I approached Uber, and I tried to pitch them on this project, and they actually said no for about a year. And one of the reasons they said no is because I had a very clear condition for doing the research, is that whatever the results were, I had the right to publish it. And you can understand why a firm like Uber would be nervous about giving that power to an outsider, but I categorically refused to do it any other way.
Uber ultimately did give Levitt their data. 54 million user sessions from four cities, Chicago, San Francisco, Los Angeles, and New York, from the first half of 2015. The result is a new working paper just released by Levitt and four co-authors, including two economists who work at Uber. You'll recall that the white whale Levitt wanted to chase with the Uber data was a real-life demand curve. There were two reasons for this.
One is that once you know the demand curve, it tells the people who are producing, the suppliers, it tells them what the right price is for them to charge. Okay, and that's how people usually think about demand curves and why they're important.
But for those of us who aren't suppliers, for those of us who are just consumers, there's another reason to be excited about the demand curve.
If you know the demand curve, then you know how much consumer surplus there is.
Consumer surplus meaning?
The extra happiness, utility, joy, willingness to pay that a consumer derives from being able to purchase a good at a given price.
Economists have been talking about consumer surplus for a couple centuries.
So some French guy named Dupuy.
As in Jules Dupuy, a 19th century economist and hydraulic engineer who helped build the sewer system of Paris.
Honestly, I'd never heard of him until I started trying to figure out who invented the concept of consumer surplus. Back in the 1840s, he came up with the idea. So when you're a consumer and you go to buy something, you have to pay a certain price. Let's talk about apples.
Okay, let's. Let's say you go to the grocery store or the farmer's market to buy some apples. You happen to want four apples, and you'd be willing to pay $1 each, $4 total. But the apples only cost 50 cents each. So the four apples cost you $2 instead of $4. The $2 that you saved from what you would have been willing to pay, that is consumer surplus.
And consumer surplus is one of the most important things in economics. One of the incredible beauties of the market system is that for so much of what we buy, we would have been willing to pay way more for it than we actually have to. And a great example is water. Okay, now, how much do we pay for water each month? I mean, I don't know what your water bill is. Mine is maybe $40. But think about how much we'd be willing to pay for water. Water is, I mean, we'd be willing to pay almost anything for water, but it's really, really cheap. So in that way, the modern economy has arranged things so that we get things we need, like water and food, much more cheaply than we'd be willing to pay. And that is really important. That is really the magic of the market.
To me, what sounds like the problem is how do you measure that? Because, like, I need to know what you, in your head, were willing to pay before you came to the store and then were confronted with the actual price. So how typically have economists measured those two numbers, what you pay and what you were willing to pay?
So, Dubner, you have never been more right about anything in your life than what you just said, because we simply have no good ways to measure consumer surplus because we know what people pay. We can sometimes see that, observe how much they buy, but we never see what's inside their head, what their joy is, what they would be willing to pay. If you really were going to estimate consumer surplus, what you would want to do is you'd want to take a consumer and somehow magically you'd want to reproduce that consumer in 10 parallel universes.
Meaning you'd put the same person in 10 different universes with different prices for the same good. So in universe one, apples would cost $1 a piece. In universe two, $2, and so on. At some point, you would find the universe where that consumer refuses to buy the apple. Maybe the universe where it costs $8.
And you would use that fact to say, well, an apple was worth something like, say, $7.50. And so the difference between what they paid and the $7.50, that would be the consumer surplus.
But I would assume that consumer surplus, even on the same good from the same person, is dynamic only because demand is dynamic, right? I might really want 4 apples today and tomorrow I'm sick of apples. How do you factor that in when you're trying to measure overall consumer surplus?
So basically, Dubner, you're on fire today. You're
really?
Asking all the right questions. What's gotten into you? No, it's exactly right. So for a given person, how much they value an apple will be different today, tomorrow, how hungry they are, whether they have a pile of apples at home. And so in essence, you'd want to do this miracle parallel universe experiment over and over and over and kind of add it up over consumers and over time. I mean, all of this, of course, is too difficult to do. And that's why in the last 250 years, we haven't really had any good estimates of consumer surplus.
How does Uber and the way that the business is run allow you to do that in a way that, let's say, asking people going to the grocery store to buy apples wouldn't?
So there are two perfect things about Uber that allow an economist to measure consumer surplus. The first is that they have surge pricing. So anyone who's taken Uber understands that sometimes when you open up the app, you see that Uber is much more expensive than other times. And that happens when there's too much demand and not enough supply of drivers.
If you've never used Uber, here's what you need to know. When you open the app to summon a car, it'll show you in big, bold numbers whether surge pricing is in effect. That is, whether Uber is charging more than the regular fare because of a demand spike. You might see 1.2x, which means the price will be 20% higher. If there's a huge spike in demand, maybe a rainy Saturday night, you might see 3x or even higher, meaning the ride will cost you 3 times or more the standard fare for that ride. So the Uber data that Levitt got hold of reflected all that, but one more thing too. It also showed when someone opened the app and saw the surge pricing and then didn't make the purchase.
And so why is that important? Because the key to estimating a demand curve is having the same consumer or similar consumers face very different prices. Okay? And so what our strategy boils down to in the end is we try to find similar consumers, and one of them opens the app and indeed sees the regular price, surge equals one, and another consumer who otherwise is essentially identical to that first consumer, they open the app and surge is, say, 2 times. So the price of a trip is twice as expensive for one person as the other. And we then compute how often does someone actually take the trip and pay for the trip when they see the regular price versus when they see a price which is a 2-time surge.
So that's a lot like the thought experiment we did before with the apples and parallel universes.
Except now we're actually seeing it on a massive scale, you know, with millions and millions of people using Uber, and we see radical difference in prices. Now, that's the first element, and that's really good. But there's something even better and hidden inside of Uber that people aren't aware of. And we have your and my good friend, Keith Chen. So Keith has built an algorithm that basically tells him exactly what he thinks the right surge price would be. But to keep things simple for customers, they only have regular price, surge equal to 1. And then sometimes it will be 1.2 or 1.3 or 1.4, but they always do rounding. So if they predict that you're like 1.25001, then they show you 1.3. If they predict that it's a 1.24999, they show you 1.2. So literally the consumers who are almost identical.
So you and I could be standing on the same street corner calling two Ubers to go to the same place, and you might get 1.3 surge price and I might get 1.2?
So that wouldn't actually happen because it's not literally done like you and I standing next to each other. But it might be that you and I are 30 minutes apart and things have changed just the tiniest bit, and that leads to a big jump in the prices. Mm-hmm. Okay, and that discontinuity is the kind of thing, a natural experiment, the kind of thing that economists, especially economists like me, look for all the time, because it's two people who are essentially identical but are shown very different prices almost by chance because of the business rule that Uber uses, because they don't want to show people complicated in-between prices.
The only reason that doesn't make sense is that when you're talking about the randomness, it sounds like the random choice is between, let's say, 1.3 and 1.2, which is not the big difference. It's not the difference between 3x and 1x. So how does that small rounding up or rounding down help accomplish the bigger goal?
Tubner, that's another amazingly perfect question. You had your economics weedies this morning. You're exactly right. So what we do is we use a series of little discontinuities. So between 1.2 and 1.3 and 1.3 and 1.4 and 2.4 and 2.5, we use a series of little tiny breaks. Okay, they're small relative to going from 1 to 5, but each of them, we have so much data. We have so many millions of observations that at each of those separate discontinuities, we can estimate the sensitivity of consumers to changes in price. And what we do is we actually build up little by little by little, little steps, tiny 0.1 steps, the entire demand curve up from price equals 1 to price equals, you know, 5 times as high.
This is what you call in the paper regression discontinuity analysis?
Exactly. So regression discontinuity is really a way of finding discrete jumps or breaks or changes that otherwise similar people are exposed to different things. And so in our case, we have something like 25 of these little discontinuities. And when you cobble together all of those 25 little natural experiments, what you have at the end is maybe the best representation of a demand curve that anyone's ever had in the real world.
Levitt, talk for just a second about surge pricing generally as an economic concept. So let's say there's a big storm forecast and a hardware store triples the price of flashlights and batteries, which in a lot of places is not allowed. There are what are called anti-gouging laws, and people get really upset about that. But how does that kind of price spike look to an economist and not someone who's just wanting to buy a flashlight?
So economists don't mind those kind of price spikes at all, because higher prices make more Uber drivers stay on the road or get on the road. In general, when there's a lot of demand for something, it's great to let the price rise because that stimulates supply and makes everybody better off.
Coming up on Freakonomics Radio, just how much consumer surplus does Uber create?
We found that the overall consumer surplus added up to almost $7 billion.
And having finally caught his white whale, Steve Levitt is instantly disappointed.
It's actually not the demand curve I wanted to estimate at all.
Also, if you find podcasts about demand curves and consumer surplus so exciting that you just can't stand it, well, maybe you should subscribe to Freakonomics Radio on iTunes or wherever you get your podcast fix.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
Steve, Steve Levitt and some colleagues used a massive database from the ride-sharing company Uber to try to measure what economists call consumer surplus, basically how much utility you get from something minus what you actually paid to get it. So I'm curious to know, A, what you were expecting to find in terms of consumer surplus, and then B, what you did find.
So I was certainly expecting to find a really big number for consumer surplus. And why is that? Well, because when you talk to people about Uber, they love it. People say, I love Uber. I don't take taxi cabs anymore. And my own experience is that I more or less love Uber too. And that is a very strong sign that people are really willing to pay more. I mean, certainly for me, I always, every time I get out of Uber, I'm like, wow, that was cheap. I would have paid a lot more for that. And that is, in essence, inside of my own head, the acknowledgement that I have a lot of consumer surplus. So I certainly expected to find that there was a lot of consumer surplus. What did we find? Well, that's exactly what we found. So we found, looking just at UberX, the one particular big kind of main product that Uber.
So this is not the fanciest cars. And it's not the pool. It's kind
exactly.
And it's used by UberX is about 80% of the rides you looked at?
Yep, that's exactly right. So we found that in 2015, if you extrapolate to the whole U.S., we found that the overall consumer surplus added up to almost $7 billion. So people spent about $4 billion on Ubers, but they actually would have been willing to spend about $11 billion. So for every dollar people spend on Uber, they got about $1.50 worth of extra joy that they would have been willing to pay on average above and beyond what they did pay. And to put into context just how big this consumer surplus is, the total amount of money that went to what Uber calls the driver partners, the people who are driving the cars, was something like $2.5 billion. So the consumers got more than twice the benefit of all the money that went to the drivers. And Uber itself only got to keep about $1 billion. So if you look at the amount that Uber, the company, kept relative to the amount that the consumers got to keep six times as much.
Now, to be clear, that consumer surplus is spread out over many more consumers than there are Uber stakeholders, or for that matter, drivers. But Levitt's finding would seem to provide ammunition for Uber itself and others who want to promote ride sharing and other resource sharing services like Airbnb. So if I'm Uber, I have your study in hand and I say, hey, Steve Levitt says we're creating $7 billion in consumer surplus in the U.S. alone in 1 year. That would seem to be the hammer with which I could smash all government resistance to Uber. So how do you think about this piece of research and research like this affecting policy?
So I don't know if it's the hammer that changes everything, but for me, I think it should change the discussion. To date, the discussion about Uber has almost always revolved around the idea that there are people who are hurt by Uber, and those would be in particular the taxicab medallion owners. Okay, and they're clearly hurt by Uber because they own an asset. They own a monopoly right to control how many cars on the street are allowed to drive people around.
And what's the magnitude of their loss to date? Do you know roughly?
So we don't have great estimates of that, but it's, you know, it might be on the order of $1 billion or something like that. Essentially, monopolies are very powerful, mm-hmm. and the cities had created monopolies through regulation. And when that monopoly gets broken, the loss of future profits is really, really quite mm-hmm. large. But many people have looked at the drivers, the taxicab drivers, and felt that they were losing a lot. But in actuality, I think that's probably not true. One of my economist friends, Judd Kramer, has written a paper. And in using pretty simple economics, his conclusion is that the taxicab drivers really haven't been helped or hurt very much, which makes a lot of sense because essentially there's always been free entry to be a taxicab driver. And with Uber, now there's another option for taxicab drivers that if they have their own car, want to rent a car, they can drive Uber. But the people who, without a doubt, are being absolutely crushed by Uber are the people who own the taxicab medallions. And there's just no way to get around that. They are the losers. And that is the nature of a market economy, is that when a new technology comes in that turns out to be a lot better for matching customers to vehicles to drive them around, and that breaks a monopoly, that those people will lose, and they will lose badly. And of course, they'll be very loud. Nobody likes to be the one who loses. But I think in this case, it's really inevitable. It's very hard to see any other future path other than medallions not being worth very much.
Uber has not replaced taxi drivers.
That's Jonathan Hall.
I'm the head of economic research for public policy and legal at Uber.
He's also one of Levitt's co-authors on the Uber paper.
So we compete vigorously for riders and for drivers.
One perk Uber likes to offer is flex time.
For example, the median Uber driver partner drives 10 hours a week. So it's not a full-time position. In New York City, the median driver drives significantly more than that. And one of the reasons for that is that there's a substantial requirement on insurance that requires that the car that the driver has be insured all of the time. And the result of that is that there's a strong economic incentive for drivers to drive a lot because they don't want to pay for a full-time insurance policy and then only drive part-time. They'll end up losing money. So we're encouraging policies that mandate things like insurance during the time when a driver is driving, but do not restrict part-time drivers from joining the platform.
Uber embodies what economists believe should happen with the labor market, because one of the real problems with jobs in places like the U.S. is that they tend to be full-time or part-time. And you have to be there for 40 hours. You have to be there from 9 to 5. You have to be there 3 days a week or 5 days a week. And the beauty of Uber from a worker's perspective is when you feel like working, you work. And when you don't want to work anymore, you stop working. And that kind of freedom to pick your hours is something that is almost completely missing in the modern labor market, but seems like a really attractive feature.
However, Uber is also working toward eliminating drivers completely. Like just about every other automotive or transportation company on Earth, it is moving as fast as it can toward autonomous vehicles. Just last month, Uber started offering rides in Pittsburgh in Volvos that drive themselves. Jonathan Hall imagines wide-ranging consequences.
The first is that the cost of getting from point A to point B will be much lower. Without paying somebody to drive the car, the cost of the ride will be lower. And so people will be encouraged to, rather than own their own cars, use services like Uber to get around. I think the more exciting opportunity than just that is that it will unlock a large number of people from, instead of driving in circles, doing other more productive things.
What kind of productive things?
I can't see the future, but we have exciting pilot programs that we've done. For example, Uber Flew, which we've done a few times, where people in Ubers are dropped off to deliver flu shots. So I think that you'll see that lots of services that are not currently delivered in home will start to be delivered in home because of the low cost of delivering them.
So that might sound appealing from Uber's perspective, and maybe yours too, but replacing all those human drivers with autonomous cars, well, that is part of a much larger and thornier conversation about technology and jobs, a conversation we've been having pretty regularly on Freakonomics Radio. For just a couple examples, you could check out an episode called How Safe Is Your Job? Or the one called The Future Probably Isn't As Scary As You Think. We also made an episode called Regulate This, which is about how companies like Uber and Airbnb are fighting government regulators. The other tricky part about predicting the future, like whether Uber Flew would even be viable, is that, well, it's hard to predict something like consumer demand. Remember, economists haven't even been very good at measuring the existing demand curve. That's what got Steve Levitt excited about the Uber data in the first place, and it worked.
So it sounds like you found the unicorn or climbed Mount Olympus, whatever. You found in the natural world the perfect demand curve, yes?
I wish that that were really true. We have estimated really, really well a demand curve. The only sad part about this, okay, I'm so excited to have estimated a demand curve, is that it's actually not the demand curve I wanted to estimate at all. It's the only one I could estimate, but not the one I really wanted. So for public policy, like in deciding how to regulate Uber, for instance, the demand curve you'd love to have is what we'd call a long-term demand curve. So we want to know how consumers would respond over the course of, say, 6 months or a year to changes in the pricing of Uber. And that would give them time to respond and make other kinds of accommodations if Uber either got more expensive or less expensive. The actual demand curve we estimate is really almost like you call it an instantaneous demand curve. Okay, I open the app, I either buy it or not.
Talk for a minute about how surge pricing with Uber affects demand. How much does it fall, if at all, between 1.2 times normal and 1.5 times normal? What's the shape of that decline?
So the elasticity of demand that we estimate overall turns out to be a number, which is like a negative 0.6 or negative 0.7. So what does that mean? That means that when the price of Uber, say, doubles, it means that the demand for Uber only falls by about 40%. So that is what an economist calls inelastic demand. And inelastic demand is a sign that people are not very sensitive to price.
That would suggest to me, again, not being an economist, that what you're trying to use price hikes for is to create an equilibrium, right? To have supply meet demand in the right place where you want it to be. So that sounds like you're not getting there. Uber's not getting there. Does that imply that surge pricing is just not going high enough to create the equilibrium? And if so, is that just out of public relations that it doesn't go higher?
So that's, again, another really good question. So it would be easier for Uber if supply and demand were really responsive, because then they would hardly have to change prices and everything would equilibrate. And so the reason we see such big swings sometimes in surge pricing is exactly because the drivers and the users are actually not very sensitive to price. And so it's not that they can't get to equilibrium. It's just that to get to equilibrium, there have to be wilder swings in prices mm-hmm. than would otherwise be the case. But I think the belief is that they actually do get to equilibrium. And I think Uber would love it if they could get to equilibrium by charging 1.2 surge instead of 3.5 surge. But it's just a fact of life that when people aren't that responsive, you need really big changes in price to
get
the job done.
All of which points to the fact that there's a huge amount of consumer surplus being created, right? I mean, that's the real story.
That's exactly right. Yeah. So when people are willing to pay a lot more, it means they're getting a lot of benefit. And that's exactly what you see.
But there's one wrinkle to think about with all that consumer surplus enjoyed by Uber customers. The company's CFO recently told investors that Uber lost more than $1.2 billion over the first half of this year. Most of that came from subsidies the company pays its drivers. How long can something like that go on? Well, as we said earlier, with a valuation north of $60 billion, probably quite a while, but not forever. Which means that Uber may well have to raise prices to cover that shortfall, which would probably begin to chip away at that massive consumer surplus that Steve Levitt and his colleagues found. Coming up on Freakonomics Radio, when you summon an Uber, do you think about the basic risk of riding in a car?
Automobiles in general are probably the most dangerous machine we interact with.
That's coming up after the break.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
So, Levitt, how good or bad a driver are you? Scale of 1 to 10?
I am one of the worst drivers on the planet. I'm a terrible driver. Awful.
Give me a number, 1 to 10?
1.
2?
1.
1? So what does it say about driving that you're one of the worst drivers who ever lived and yet you're still alive?
Well, we have great technology. So when I bang into things, neither I nor the things I hit get hurt very badly. Uh-huh. And we have great developments, like people have very loud horns that they blow at me, and they have really very vivid brake lights and other things that flash in front of me telling me I have to stop.
And they have built technology in the sides of roads so that when I'm veering off my lane in towards the grass, it goes da-dump, 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 and reminds me to go back on. So I think there are a lot of safeguards in there to keep me from killing myself in a car.
Why do you think you're such a bad driver, Levitt? You're relatively good at some other things.
I'm very distracted as a driver. I don't pay very much attention.
What distracts you? Is it stuff in your head, or are you reaching for the hamburger or the music? What is it?
Partly it's in my head, and I just am thinking about other things. But I am an incessant channel changer on the radio. I'm always in search of a better song than the one that's currently playing. And I talk on the phone and I text. I do all the things you're not supposed to do. I'm pretty much a walking time bomb when it comes to driving.
For more than a century, the car has been an extraordinarily convenient way to get around. It changed the way we think about distance. And for many of us, the car is an irreplaceable utility and a vanity. We love our cars. We might even imagine they love us back. But here's one more thing about the car. It's a death trap.
You can see what a mess it is. This is the scene as it is right now.
Alcohol played a role in an early morning crash that took the lives of five young men.
A 36-year-old mother drove her minivan more than a mile and a half against traffic on a highway.
A 12-year-old boy was hit.
A charter bus with 55 churchgoers flew off a Texas freeway overpass.
A pair of 20-somethings in the car, a male driver and a female passenger, never had a chance.
Automobiles in general are probably the most dangerous machine we interact with.
Ian Savage is an economist at Northwestern who studies transportation safety.
If you look at the only other one which would come close would be firearms, where if you include together their homicides, accidents, and suicides, you're probably getting numbers which are sort of up in the same sort of 30,000 range.
In the U.S., there are more than 35,000 deaths a year from motor vehicle crashes. Worldwide, there are about 1.2 million deaths a year. Now, what is it that causes all those crashes? That's what we'll be talking about in today's program. One thing I'll tell you right off the bat is that more than 90% of those deaths are the result of driver error. It doesn't help that people like Steve Levitt are out there sending texts and looking for Miley Cyrus on the radio. Recent studies show that texting while driving roughly doubles your chance of crashing. Distracted driving would seem to be an obviously bad idea. But before we go forward, let's go back to when the car was new, to the late 19th century. The cars then looked more like big bicycles than the cars we drive today, and the roads were essentially horse paths. They were rutted and muddy and clogged with manure. And back then, it was the cars that were the distraction. Lawmakers in the US and the UK tried to ensure that the car didn't cause too much trouble.
Back in the very early days of automobiles, when people thought this was sort of going to scare the cows and the local populace, they for a while actually required people to walk in front of this newfangled machine carrying a red flag so the vehicle could proceed at sort of snail's pace and you're being warned that something new and unusual was coming.
There were people who said that if God wanted people to get around in cars, he wouldn't have made horses.
That's Carol Lambert. Her great-grandfather, John Lambert, was not one of those people. He is known as the inventor of the first gas-powered car in America. And, not too coincidentally, he's also known as having caused the first automobile crash.
You know, there's a marker in Ohio City marking where that first accident took place.
What does that marker say?
It says, site of America's first accident.
Here's what happened.
So John was sitting high on the seat of his car, and he had a passenger with him. And he knew darn well that the streets were rutted, and also there were tree stumps that dotted the roads, and roots were protruding. I'm kind of thinking he was talking to his buddy there. And the protruding root turn that little front wheel, and the car went peppering into the side of the road where there was a horse's hitching post.
Oh, that's very metaphoric somehow, that the car hits the horse's hitching post. It's like the future is trying to knock the past further into the past.
Oh, that's good, Stephen. I hadn't thought of that. That's good.
John Lambert and his friends survived the crash just fine, but today, more than a century later, we are all accustomed to the huge toll of traffic fatalities. Remember, more than 33,000 a year in the U.S. alone. Traffic accidents are one of the leading causes of death in the U.S. and easily the top cause of accidental death. While the Great Recession curtailed driving a bit, and there's some talk that we may have reached peak motorization, there are still more of us driving more miles than ever before, with more potential distractions, too. Our mobile devices, our lattes, our noisy kids, our podcasts. But what if I told you that we've actually been getting safer? True story. Remember how Steve Levitt was telling us what a terribly distracted driver he is?
I am an incessant channel changer on the radio. And I talk on the phone and I text. I'm pretty much a walking time bomb when it comes to driving.
What you're describing are all these distractions, many of which are modern ones. And then there are all these other technological and engineering and design improvements, which are also modern. So does this mean that the improvements are winning out over the distractions? Do you think that all the driving distractions that people worry about so much now are just being kind of washed away by the fact that we're getting better at keeping people from killing themselves in cars?
Well, the data certainly support that view. If you look at the path of fatalities on the roads per mile driven, it's an amazing success story.
And here again is Ian Savage, the Northwestern economist.
The rate of fatal crashes per automobile mile driven has declined by 2/3 since 1975.
Wow. And so people understand there's a big difference, obviously, between rate and amount. So there are more people in the country and we drive more than we did in 75. So if you look at just the raw numbers, the number won't have fallen as much. But you're saying that the rate has fallen by about 2/3 in the last 40 years, yes?
That's correct. In terms of a total count, we were up at just over 50,000 around about 1980. And now we're heading into the low 30,000s.
Wow. So that is amazingly good news, yes? I mean, we can't deny that.
Oh, no, it's excellent news, yeah.
So how did we get here? How did we get to the point where the rate of traffic deaths has fallen by 2/3 in the last few decades? Well, clever people have been thinking about how to make auto travel safer pretty much since the beginning of auto travel. Now, let's be clear. There has been a lot of trial and error. First, let's consider a few of the errors. Around the turn of the 20th century, there was a cow catcher on cars, a fender meant to scoop animals off the road. Didn't work so well. Later, there was a tire covered with suction cups meant to improve grip, which was a failure. And the auto entrepreneur Preston Tucker, who had many great car ideas, also had this one, as described by automotive writer Brett Burke.
He designed what they called the crash compartment, which was a padded area that was under the dash on the passenger side where riders would crawl when a collision was imminent, sort of an automotive bomb shelter. And the idea being, I guess, that you would have the wherewithal to jump out of your seat and jump into this padded crash compartment in the event of an accident.
Okay, but there were a lot of good ideas, too.
A surprisingly large proportion of highway fatalities occur when there isn't even a collision with another vehicle. So it's when a vehicle leaves the highway without a prior collision. So over half of the fatalities.
That's Ian Savage.
And obviously what you're doing there is you're either rolling off down the embankment or even something worse, you're colliding with a fixed object, usually a bridge abutment. So I think there's been a lot of developments in crash barriers where you are improving the highway, but it isn't exactly the highway surface itself.
So
all of these road improvements, any one of which may seem relatively minor, they've combined to save a lot of lives. And then there's the seatbelt, one of the most important auto safety inventions yet. The seatbelt came along in the 1950s, but it took a long time for it to catch on. Car makers did not like to promote the seatbelt because they worried that a seatbelt implied that cars were dangerous, which they were, especially back then when car interiors were made of much harder materials than they are today. Until the 1980s, seatbelt use was only 10 or 15%, but today we're up to about 86%, which is great news because a seatbelt reduces the risk of death by as much as 70%. And at about $25 a pop, the seatbelt is one of the most cost-effective life-saving devices ever invented. There's one life saved in the U.S. for every $30,000 worth of seatbelts installed in cars. And compare that to about $1.8 million per life saved for an airbag. Ian Savage has some other ideas about why the auto death rate has fallen so much, especially since the 1970s. For starters, Savage says, there's a lot less drunk driving, thanks to tougher laws and social pressure. Over the last 10 years, alcohol-related traffic fatalities have fallen by 28%. Also, driver demographics have changed. Younger drivers tend to be more dangerous, and now there are relatively fewer of them.
I looked in the 1980 census and saw 18 to 29-year-olds were 30% of the population. By 2000, that number was down to 22%, which is what it is now. So in other words, the baby boom has passed its way through the, shall we say, the risky driver stage. So I think this is a really important aspect.
Another factor, says Ian Savage, is increasing urbanization. Driving in a city might seem dangerous because there are a lot of other cars and people and buildings and whatnot, but rural areas, those wide open stretches where you can go a lot faster and hit a tree or another car, those are in fact three times more dangerous. So, with more people living in cities, fewer traffic deaths. And then there are cell phones. That's right, cell phones. Ian Savage tells us that cell phones, as distracting as they would seem to be while you're driving, may also be responsible for saving lots of lives.
You always hear the medical professionals talking about this sort of golden hour of after the trauma occurs of getting high-quality medical care. So, I mean, it's easy probably for you and me to remember not that long ago where if you had a crash in a rural area, boy, how would you go and phone to tell someone this has happened? You have to get a passing motorist who would have to drive to the nearest town or something like that. So clearly there's that aspect of things. So, I mean, I think that my observation of the cell phones and safety literature is that it's controversial. There are findings both ways in terms of the overall effect.
So cell phones may drive auto fatalities down in that they let us call for help after a crash. But as Ian Savage acknowledges, that benefit may be outweighed by the cost of the distraction. So here's a question for you. When researchers are trying to figure out just how dangerous a given distraction may be, how do they know? They're not sitting there in the passenger seat with distracted drivers, or are they? We talked to Greg Fitch with the Virginia Tech Transportation Institute, which conducts what are known as naturalistic driving studies.
My name is Greg Fitch.
No, they don't ride along with drivers. They put video cameras in their cars. Now, I know what you're thinking. What about the observer effect? Won't a driver who's being taped always be on his best behavior? Greg Fitch says no.
People soon forget that they're actually being recorded. And the way we are able to determine this is we see them do all kinds of ridiculous things that no one in their right mind would do if they're being videotaped, unless they're on a reality TV show. But we have evidence of people talking on two phones at once while smoking a cigarette while driving through a work zone and running a yellow light. We've seen videos of drivers relieving themselves behind the wheel. For the over-the-road drivers, you know, we've seen examples of them actually, you know, meeting with a prostitute behind the wheel, you know? So these are things that you don't actually see in an empirical laboratory study. This is true driver behavior that we're capturing.
Okay, so when you can watch drivers driving and try to measure the effect of various distractions, what do you find? One conclusion, talking on the phone doesn't seem to be a very big deal. Fitch says that people talk on a cell phone about 10% of the time they're driving, and he and his team found that whether a driver is holding the phone or not, that talking on the phone, while not recommended, does not increase the risk of a crash. In fact, it can even be associated with a positive outcome.
It's been proposed that talking on the phone actually reduces boredom. There's been research that shows that people are more awake, more alert, up to 20 minutes after having a cell phone conversation. It's kind of like, you know, drinking a cup of coffee or taking a caffeine pill.
And if that's not surprising enough, how about this?
A big theory that was proposed over the last 2 years is that people might actually be adapting or changing the way they drive while talking on the phone to kind of mitigate the risk.
In other words, we seem to be getting better at multitasking, at least when it comes to driving and talking. But what if you stop talking on your phone and start using it for something else, like texting or checking your fantasy football lineup? That is bad news.
Anything that's dangerous behind the wheel, they all have a commonality, and that is when you take your eyes off the road, you're at an elevated risk. It's been shown time and time again. Reaching for the phone, dialing, texting, even putting the phone away, are associated with an increased risk. Whether you're eating a burger, whether you're putting on makeup, you know, those all have commonalities, and that is you should not take your eyes off the road when driving.
So there's a dilemma. We are so dependent on our cars, at least for the foreseeable future, but when driving them, we are our own worst enemy. It's nice to know that driving has gotten relatively safer, but remember, there's still 1.2 million traffic deaths a year worldwide, not to mention 20 to 50 million injuries, and of course, a huge attendant financial cost. So what if we look at the slightly less foreseeable future? What if we look at the driverless car? No one can say exactly when or how it will happen, but it could well be that 7 or 10 or 15 years from now, most cars have the ability to drive us rather than vice versa. A lot of the necessary technology is already in a lot of cars, GPS and onboard computers, sensors and cameras. And just about every major car maker, along with Google, is testing driverless cars with much success. Now, there will be a lot of wrinkles to work out, of course, but in theory, a computer-operated car will be much safer than a human-operated car. It won't drive drunk or while putting on mascara while trying to open the packet of ketchup. There will, of course, still be accidents. Fred Kripe worked for Allstate Insurance for 31 years. He's now a consultant.
I think in the future, what you'll find is when vehicles are involved in accidents, it will simply be the guidance system didn't work in this case, and whoever's guidance system is in the vehicle pays for the loss.
I asked Ian Savage, the transportation economist, to try to predict some other advantages of the driverless car.
When you talk about older drivers and diminished driving skills amongst older drivers, the autonomous vehicle could change their lives tremendously and also improve the safety of the pedestrians who have to walk around these elderly drivers driving on the streets. But I think the biggest gain is not going to be safety related, it's going to be in road space and the issue of congestion. Because if we can get by the issue of the fact that on most highways there are large gaps between automobiles, so there's hence a lot of wasted space on the highway, if we can now have vehicles moving faster and closer together, we can make a big dent in urban highway congestion.
I'm Stephen Dubner, and that was Freakonomics Radio. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week. If you can't wait that long, you can find our entire Freakonomics Radio podcast archive at Freakonomics.com or at iTunes, where you can also subscribe.